And we're live with our 329th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode. We're excited to be here as always. Wanted to give a shout out on a couple of things. Appreciate all the interactions over the last few weeks. Great to have Coffee KS and ProdSec guys on the show, and then also being on the show with them. Please go check that out. That released last week as well, the crossover episode we did when Ken and I went on their episode. And that discussion that we had was really interesting. So, with that though, episode 329, I do want to give a shout out to Guard Square for being the sponsor of this episode. Think about your mobile app's source code. Once it hits the App Store, it's out in the wild, and without the right protection, decompiling it is easy for malicious actors looking to steal your IP and tamper with your software. That's where Guard Square comes in. Guard Square provides the highest level of mobile app security for Android and iOS applications and SDKs. Their advanced tools integrate seamlessly into your CI/CD pipeline. We're talking polymorphic, multi-layered code hardening techniques and automated runtime application self-protection paired with mobile application security testing and real-time threat modeling to deliver the highest level of mobile app security without compromise. Don't leave your hard work exposed. Secure mobile applications today. Go to guardsquare.com to learn more. Again, appreciate them. And how they support us. They've got some really great tools. We're gonna have one of their technical resources come on very soon, I think in September sometime, to actually talk through some mobile threats. We haven't done a mobile episode in a while. That scene, I know we've moved on from it a little bit, Ken. We used to do a whole bunch of mobile testing when we were back at Fishnet, you and I. Right, like Android, iOS. I still do a fair amount of mobile AppSec stuff on the code side and then also on the testing side, but it's not the majority of what we do. So it's really interesting to talk with the vendors that are protecting that sort of thing. You've popped that up. Training is still available for DEF CON and Black Hat, switching topics. If you are looking last minute, Black Hat starts on Saturday, so not sure if you want to make that switch or you want to make that jump if you haven't signed up yet. But DEF CON is the DEF CON training is the 2 days after DEF CON, so it's what I think the 10th and 11th, August 10th and 11th. And would love to have you there. It's a good opportunity to learn how to actually utilize LLMs and harness LLMs to do application security things. I don't know what else I would necessarily say about that outside of we have a bunch of content to update because everything changes every 2 weeks or every week or every day in the space. And that's what we're heads down doing right now.
Every time, man, I wish I could just like when we did the secure code review, you could pretty much just like set it and forget it with minor updates here and there. Like, I like things like, it's like, I don't know. At one point, we showed, I think, a way to search for paths not using SemGrep, like regular search. And then later, when SemGrep came out, we were like, oh, use SemGrep for annotations or to like find missing annotations or route definitions or whatever things you want. And then, like, then it went into like more AI centric. And, it's just, but not huge updates. Now with AI, it's like, oh my God, it's like every 2 seconds, like the whole thing changes again. So every time we give this course, it requires so much freaking work, but it's worth it. But I don't know, since you said that, I was like, oh yes, it is. It's not easy. It's non-trivial.
It's non-trivial. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it too has to do with the libraries and other things as we're trying to support people. Like, what's the latest and greatest way to accomplish a secure code review, right? Like using AI agents and building out agentic harnesses. It's gotten easier, but the the frameworks and the libraries that we use change on a weekly basis. And sometimes I do feel like even the stuff that I write to do, you know, dynamic testing or that we're actually utilizing there requires a fair amount of engineering to make it work properly. And keeping those libraries even up to date, right? Like minor version changes. Yeah. They say they're minor versions, but when they change completely, like the inner workings of how they're dealing with a non-deterministic system, it's just a good luck, right? Like you have to go back to the drawing board half the time. So, and you know, I know we'll get into it with the course. Like if you want more of that sort of insight, come to one of our courses and you will hear us complain for at least a couple of days, right? About dealing with LLMs. Outside of that, there's a few articles that we wanted to discuss today. First up though, we are going to be having a, sorry, I forgot this. I was going to mention it. It's on my list. We have a happy hour that we're going to run on August 6th, if I remember right. There's a Luma link for people to sign up for it. We did pop it into Slack last week. If you missed it, you did find it.
I'll put it in. I left that YouTube link up. Oops. No worries. All right, there you go.
Yep. So if you're available on August 6th and would like to join us, we will be having a happy hour. Would love to see everyone if you're going to be in Vegas for Hacker Summer Camp and not going to training or whatever it is. We're going to be wandering around. I have some stickers. We have other things. Ken has a new pair of Crocs, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, get him because he's in shorts. Mine. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll get mine. Just. Yes. These are the ones that, sorry, there, these.
Sweet, yes.
I haven't worn them yet. Just saving them for Vegas, but yeah, should be good. I'm excited.
Yep, and again, Crocs. Yeah, that's how we all do it. That's all good. Sweet. So
it'd be a BrewDog. The other thing I was going to say about this place too is like, it's okay. So if you were there last year, obviously you were there last year, but for everybody who was, if you were there last year, we went to, I think, Yardbird or something like that. And the way we did it is we just ordered like food to just kind of rotate, you know, every so often there'd be new food refresh, like, you know, bar food kind of stuff. And then you could just order drinks and you just put it on our tab. And then we probably had, I don't know, we'll say 40 or plus people rotate, like in total rotating in and out. But at any given time, I think there was like 12 to 15 kind of people at the table or whatever, something like that, if my memory serves me correctly. So that's going to be how we were running it this year too. It's basically like, yes, it's within this window. If you can't get there at whatever time it starts, I think it's like maybe 6:30 or something. That's okay. Just come on in whenever, before we leave there and rotate in, rotate out, come as you'd like and leave as you'd like. So that's how it's going to roll. Easy.
Yep. It's going to be chill. I think that's all that we can handle at this point is chill. All
we can handle. Yeah. Because cool. By that point, we'll have already been there for almost a week. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You want to come see us, you know, burned out of Vegas after. That'll be a good spot to do it. Sweet. Today, there's a few episodes or a few articles that I pulled in that I wanted to discuss from various sources. Obviously, like, I'm wondering if we should talk about OpenAI and Hugging Face. Like last week on the podcast, OpenAI had not fessed up to the fact that they were the ones that had hacked Hugging Face yet. As we actually gave, as we recorded the show. I wondered, Ken, like, I don't think we have to dig into the specifics here outside of, you know, OpenAI's model Like they were supposedly doing some testing. They'd taken off the production guardrails. It found a couple of ODEs with like a cache proxy and was trying to, you know, find solutions for exploit Gem, knew that Hugging Face maybe was one of the sources for that. And that's what it went after. That being said, what are your thoughts on this? Like just in general, these models that are supposedly so dangerous that we can't let them on the internet, right? Like, especially with, from a security perspective, with when performing security tasks, I just want your general thoughts on this, and then I'll kind of give mine as well. How do you feel about this? The fact that OpenAI and their model actually hacked an LLM provider, Hugging Face, right? Like, what are your thoughts around it?
No, I mean, the things I can remember from the article were for one that they spent, they said a significant amount of inference compute. So question mark, how much money did it actually cost? Right. Like that's one question mark. Another question mark is, if I remember also correctly, they said that it had the capability to find and discover, maybe it's in there. I'm going to search for a word. Hold on, give me one sec, because right. So this was weird. They said the incident also makes clear that advanced models can discover and exploit novel attack paths in real world systems without source code access. So, for one, what do you consider novel? Because up to this point, there's no evidence to support that entirely new categories of vulnerabilities or entirely new attack paths are something that models are capable of developing on their own so far. The evidence has shown that they're trained on patterns, they're trained on data, and that's what they are able to stay within, right? Is meaning like it understands what IDOR looks like and it understands the general shape of IDOR, which brings me to my next point. It says we can do this without finding or without access to source code. Yeah, but Burp Suite can do that too, right? For the cost of a human being who's behind it, and a subscription if it's not free, you know, or if you need threading or whatever, right? Like a little tongue in cheek there, but truth be told, yeah. Like, so I guess why I'm saying all this, what that actually sounds to me, what that sounds like to me is that a marketing and sales and other business people got together and said, can we say these things in this order and it not be like pushed back on too hard? And they're probably like, yes. And I'm saying that because I'm almost positive what happened was it spent a bajillion fucking dollars to try and like send a bunch of requests, found like probably an endpoint that wasn't protected by authentication, or maybe it was an iDorable, whatever endpoint, sent some fuzzing requests, escalated from that point forward, you know what I mean? Using completely normal, completely. So these are question marks. I'm not saying that's the case, but I'm saying to me, if you're asking me, what I'm hearing are enough words put in the right sequence in the right order without enough detail to where it could go either way. It could be like, oh, maybe this is something we've never apparently heard of before and, you know, whatever. But I think what I'm actually reading is, yeah, cool, it brute forced something, a known type of vulnerability category that already exists. Again, spent a lot of money to probably brute force that. Might have chained a couple things together. Great, anybody can do that. Yeah, it's a lot of question marks, more questions than answers. However, what I will say with OpenAI is I will always, at this point right now, I will give their marketing team more of a benefit of a doubt than I would Anthropic. So that's the last thing we'll say there.
Okay. Yeah.
Now your thoughts.
I mean, that was my initial question, right? Like when this popped up and it came out that it was OpenAI, okay, is this their Mythos moment, right? Like that they're trying to get at least some of the marketing or get their name out there as they have a dangerous model, right? And the way that they've crafted it is is pretty smart, right? To your point, right? Like, oh, it's a novel attack. Yeah, when you read through it, it's like it found a flaw in this cache proxy that it was able to use to actually like get out to the internet and then utilize that path to go after Hugging Face and found a couple other things there, right? Like, so okay, yes, it's novel because we didn't know that there was an exploit in that, you know, that cache proxy that they were using, right? Yeah, all right, it found a vulnerability there. It found a vulnerability in Hugging Face. You know, there, so it's definitely finding things. How much money is being spent? That brought up some, you know, questions in my mind as well, like the amount of inference and the amount of token cost that's going into this, because you and I both know it's not cheap, right? Like it's incredibly expensive to use these frontier models to do this sort of work. Mm-hmm. And there's no guarantee that they are more cost effective than a person with a fuzzer with a very targeted scope. I know that they're going to get less expensive, and you know, people are using them, and we're using open source models to make them more effective, but the amount of money that they're spending on this sort of activity is not something that's easily replicated outside of being in one of those organizations.
I've thought about this, which is like part of me thinks this is setting themselves up for like a big ploy for like military cyber contracts, because mm-hmm. I was thinking about like, yeah, at a certain point, these models are just a model. It's just a capability. It's not any more important or less important than other models. Like some are better than others at certain things and whatever. But like, I think we're enough people have used models at this point to realize like it's one part of an ecosystem. It's a very important part. It's like the, you know, incredibly important part, but it's not the only part. And also, again, there's lots of different models. So there's lots of open source models now that are like better, right? And I mean, like, at least from a so why I'm saying this is, all right, you put out something, and then you're like, okay, well, guess what, if I was to release this to the world, it could exploit things. Well, not if I release it to the world. If I release it to somebody who had enough money, which means who has enough money? Well, typically high level organized crime organizations or nation state actors, right? Who's gonna so then it becomes, okay, well, you know, if high-level offensive actors have this capability, and then low-level offensive actors have lesser capabilities, but some degree of like automated, can find things really quickly, chain it, find flaws in your website, whatever. So then people will go to like the defense, like, okay, well, I've got to have AI to fight AI, right? And so they'll go to companies like mine and other companies and say, yeah, we'll need to use your system, and then we'll handle all the nuances. Or they'll build their own thing and they'll use the open source LLMs. They want, my guess, I don't see a world in which, like, I deal with this all day long. I have a product built around these. I don't see a world in which like frontier models end up, I mean, I don't even use them. Like they're just not, it just costs a lot of money. Rate limits are horrible. You have to go through certain providers to get them. Lots of other issues, don't need to get into, but I don't see it. So who do they become really useful for? Well, a big part of me has been thinking like stuff like this. This is like how you set yourself up for those huge, like billions of dollars, you know, of government money kind of contracts. It's like, mm-hmm. Then you look at like how now nations are saying, well, you can use these models, but not these models, and China's models versus US models. You know what I mean? So I to me, this is starting to become more of like a defense, kind of like a military defense. Boy and route that they seem to be leaning more and more into. And then I was watching Palantir's CEO, that nutcase, like, go off about how irresponsible they are, and I'm like, that's ironic, okay. So I'm like, all right, they're irresponsible, great. Anyways, good to know. So then I think about like, but what's their angle on that, right? And so I don't know, there's just enough things that I've kind of seen where I'm like, maybe the like cyber defense capabilities are really, and offense capabilities are where they're kind of, these companies might lean into to make money in the future, because otherwise, like, I mean, I'm not going to pay
support.
We talked to somebody who was using low level amounts of Mythos, and it cost him $5,000 a day. I've said this multiple times. I was blown away, and I'm like, okay, so if you're a big enterprise, you're, I mean, maybe you just don't care about money. Maybe that's True, but if you do care about money, like I don't see it being practical. So, anyways, I don't know. They're just thoughts, Seth. They're just thoughts.
I don't want to spend the whole episode on this because I do feel like it, it's been talked about in the space for a while, for a while, it's been like 6 days, right? So of course, everybody's kind of,
An
run
opinion.
through it or have it has their own opinion on it. But I did want to just get your take. So
You know why
I
you
mean,
want to get my
watch it.
take? Because I won't have re read anything anyone said. I don't know shit about what's going on. I just read highlights and like give horrible takes. That's why you like
Makes for really good copy later. Yes,
That's just
exactly.
ignorant. That's why. Those ignorant ginger just giving opinions. Yeah. Anyways.
What? Yeah, never mind. We'll get into that later. Okay, so I want to go back to Crocs and socks then, right? Like, bag this, right? Like, AI has taken over the world. There was a really good article. There's been a couple of them that have come out recently. And it feels like AI is actually pushing us this directory, right? So this is from Sev Hunt and Sam Mortensen. I don't know who it is, but I you know he puts out a he put out a blog post, and I think it just actually came out today, designing patterns to prevent IDOR. Insecure direct object reference. Justin on my team has all sorts of feelings about IDOR. It's basically, what has paid our salaries, and it seems like Sam's over there at Sev Hunt as well for a long time, because authorization is hard. Now, if we go back to Crocs and socks, like the basics of security, there is triple A, right? Like there's the this idea that all security devolves, controls devolves to authentication, authorization, and auditing. Authorization is one of these core principles and controls that needs to exist in an application to prevent or to basically define what a person can actually do, what they can access, what functions and data they can get access to, right? Like within an application, if you don't have that control, you have no security, and you may as well just, throw it all away, or you have to start over. But insecure direct object reference, from a basics perspective, is the ability to provide an ID to an application to either perform a function or get access to a record, right? Using an ID. So insecure direct object reference means that ID, that reference, is not controlled properly, and we can actually look up functions and we can look up data by providing alternate IDs to an application. Very simple concept. So if you trust the user to provide you with an ID, you do a database lookup and provide back, their profile information, including their password hash or date of birth or something like that. If an attacker changes that ID from a zero, or so from a one to a two, and they can see someone else's data, it's bypassing these authorization controls.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you're saying,
So,
right?
yeah. So what Sam's done in this article is actually examined a few different techniques to remediate IDOR. And I want to give him props here, because I don't see enough of this in just security research in general. A lot of these sorts of articles will come out and be like, hey, look at this cool thing that I did and how I exploited it, but doesn't go into the nuances of how to prevent this from happening, and then also the pros and cons of these different approaches, right? So doing lookups in this manner, right? Like, you're wrapping these raw values during validation, but this also means that there's database lookup costs that go into it, and it will cause other problems to occur, and maybe you're sacrificing a little bit of usability for security. But him stepping through these ideas is a really kind of great approach to what a developer actually needs, right? Like, how do I resolve this? What are the cost-benefit analysis to implementing any of these approaches? And I don't know if we necessarily need to go into this, the very specifics of this. Like, he's talking about it from a TypeScript perspective, the different ways that you can actually remediate it. Like, so in this case, the one that we're looking at, they're already using Zod, right? So they're doing some user input validation that are here, just making sure that the incoming stream is a valid UUID before it's being passed back to do the lookup. So they're mixing right? Like,
they're also tying the organization ID to that current. Mm-hmm. So the Zod wrapped organization UUID basically maps the current user ID and the organization ID. So it's validation and authorization in one function.
Yeah, which is in one go.
Weird, but he says a little weird.
It does feel a little weird, but it could work, right? Like, because you've already got that organization ID tied to a user, and that lookup has to happen somewhere, right? Like, we do similar approaches, like if you were doing this in decorators as well, right? Like, oh, you have a very specific function that's matching that user and organization together, and then returning false if it isn't, or 401 unauthorized, whatever, right?
Yeah, so, I think it's weird because you are doing two operations in one. Like, validation is supposed to be validation, authorization is supposed to be auth. It's not bad, but it does. I feel like other things could go wrong. You know what I mean? Like, in this kind of scenario, maybe I'm completely off there, but I don't like mixing two layers together like that. That's the only thing I would say.
Yeah, I mean we've seen that problem before, right? Like, the more that you mash into a single like validation routine, whole bunch of if else's and that sort of thing actually leads to really weird conditions. Or when you fall out, and if you can make it to the end, it falls out as true, even though you set like organization ID to 00 or something like that, right? So let's see, returning objects instead of closures, right?
Class that uses TypeScript's private word.
Uses private keyword, right? Like, one of them is actual like lookup of
So it actually creates an unsafe raw ID object from that private function. Let's see, so does model is the table with ID, so we've got the organization ID to look up the organization, then we go table ID, so the unsafe raw ID gets passed into the where clause with an equal statement, so the table ID has to match the raw unsafe raw ID, and the table ID is given for organization ID. So UID transform ID to wrapped model ID. Okay. So transfer. So that's how it makes sure that I'm a little confused though, like on we're making sure there's an equal. Where does the table come from? I guess that's the from table as PG table. This table organized. So having the ID, what is his take on this? Having the ID accessible without closures also enables you to provide the library functions. Having the ID accessible without closures also enables you to provide library functions for bulk.
So this is all still part of that same idea number one, right? Wrapping the value.
Because I'm like
validation.
That.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, that makes more sense then.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so I mean, it's just a way. So he's trying to basically make it so the organization ID can still be easily looked up without the user ID, right? So there's still some ability to do that. I like, what's more interesting from a IDOR perspective is that adding a tenant ID to every query. This is a standard design recommendation. Right?
You know what the problem is? I thought this was idea too. I didn't realize it's a continuation. I was like, I don't understand how it's actually going to protect you, because you're still just giving a raw ID. Like, I don't understand. There's no like, all right, that makes total fucking sense. I'm like, Dude, I'm so confused. How's that actually like fixing anything? All right, cool.
It's not.
Idea
It's not.
two, yes. Add a tenant ID into every query. Yeah. So this is something I want to say. Like so when I design, I created a RESTful API. Actually, you've looked at the code for that RESTful API. You'll have noticed that, especially because it's an MVC, I think it's easy enough to just inherit from a base class that enforces. But the problem is that when you get into like discrete object modifications, right? So like the easy ones, like, yeah, you have an admin panel, and so everything inherits from the admin controller and it has an admin enforcement on it. Great, that's great, right? And then you're gonna have normal IDOR that's good IDOR, that's expected, right? Because you're an admin, you should be able to like modify, I don't know, we'll say any article you want, for instance. But then there's like maybe other things that you're not supposed to be able, like other admins, I don't know, passwords or something like that. Maybe you're not supposed to be able to do that, to like change that. And that's where it gets really hard, and it gets to be a bit more nuanced. Is like those little, it's like, yes, I can protect in so many ways, but there will still be times where I have to do some bespoke operation, and or I may introduce some bespoke operation for a very good reason. And so it gets a little, yeah, it just gets a little. Sorry, I got distracted by Larry's. Ken's had his coffee today. Yes, I have had the coffee, all the coffee today. Yeah, I forget where I was going with that. Bottom line is, like, if you're there, yes, you can do like many ways. Like this is a good example, right? Where he's saying there will always be a consistent tenant ID, right? So that you make sure it's always the right. Yes, stuff like that's great. It's just IDOR exists because there's always a reason that you have to, like, I feel like people always like need flexibility. That's what I'm really trying to say. And I think flexibility is why we always have issues.
Yeah, in describing my job to people, I always say that I live in the edge cases, right? Like where I find interesting vulnerabilities is in the edge cases. And I'll be honest, like this kind of standard IDOR where you can change, one UUID to another and see somebody else's data, we still see it in most of our reports and it still exists, and like changing the organization, like in the case that he's talking about here. Yeah, that's it's important that we talk about it, right? Like that it is some of the basics for authorization controls, but the more nuanced and more complex a role-based access control system gets, the more likely it is that there will be edge cases that can be exploited. And so thinking through those abilities and those like multi-tenant systems, exactly like you're describing, where you have multiple administrators or multiple sets of administrators and what they should be able to access. And then if you give those administrators the ability to actually control access as well and build out their own policies, what does that actually equate to, and how do you run through testing on that? It is a very, very complex environment that you step into, and there are going to be failures, which is the whole reason that we do security testing, is to flush those out. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a third party that does that, but you've got to have a very good understanding of where those controls exist and what each role is defined to be able to do in order to prevent something like that from happening. And something like this. Like these are good basic steps to actually take or think about when implementing those systems. Yeah. Anyway,
Yeah, that's by the
let's see.
way, just want to continue that on that thread too. Like going back to, sorry, looking at this code right here, right? Going back to what we were talking about, I was like, this is interesting. There's two levels, right? There's like the making sure that your org ID provided matches the table of the tenant that you're trying to access. So the org ID of the tenant. What am I trying to say? They're hard coding in the table basically that you're allowed to access. And then that org ID on that table has to match the org ID that you're passing in. That's one level. But then if you look at when it gets called, with Safe Select, there's a second level where they want to actually make sure that the report ID that you're modifying matches the report ID that you've provided. So like, unless I'm crazy or whatever, there's almost like, again, this is great, but then there also tends to be like a second level check somewhere else. And that's, if I'm reading that all correctly, that's the crux of the issue I have with, or we all have with IDOR, is that it's like, you can put 2, 3, 4, 5 level. I was just on a demo call earlier where I was explaining how our code policies work, and that one of our customers has like many ridiculous, and you know this customer, by the way, many crazy ways to like do high level authorization on GraphQL, and then many lower level ways to do that, and why it's so complex to find those kinds of issues, and why, like, yeah, regex doesn't work, determinism's like just crap, it's not gonna work, and why that is the way that it is. And it comes down to, well, if you have a very complex system, there's going to be like cascading levels of authorization, and it's very easy to make a mistake. That's really what it comes down to. It's very easy. Like, I've talked about this before on the podcast, but at GitHub, we had a authorization testing framework, like a whole framework built for just authorization testing. And the matrix was just like insane for all different actor types, all different ways that actors could access the app, the different parts of the apps and their different expectations around each one of those actors. Just insane. And that's kind of what you have to do when you get to a certain level of complexity in any application to avoid authorization problems.
Yeah. I mean, like, I know it's basics, right? Like, but if you don't have that level of understanding, I most likely would be going straight towards using some sort of agent to help me figure out what's going on with authorization in an application itself, right? Like the testing that goes into that. And we've started to do more and more of that, utilizing, you know, Codex or Claude to actually break that down and create those unit tests. Because most apps and most teams that I walk into nowadays don't have that level of sophistication when it comes to authorization. They just don't. So one of the first things that I do is take the time to figure it out. And then guess what we find every single time? Like one that I was running just yesterday, right? Like, you know, hey, there's a billing role within a specific like healthcare application, and the billing role only has access to actually send out bills and check to see what's there. But on that same level, it has admin level credentials. So if you call the API directly using its creds, you can actually dump everyone's data, right? Like including things that it shouldn't have access to, and create new users and all of this crazy stuff because of, you know, it's a protected type role, but we haven't put the controls around it that we did, like the administrator, the other, you know, the other people that are going to be logged in there. So anyway. You know, from a basics perspective, check out that article, Sevhend. It's really, you know, it is really quite good. You know, it's a good thought exercise if you're dealing with IDOR and what you're recommending to developers to actually go and do. And I know we didn't get into that last idea that was in there either, the, you know, distinctly type your primary keys. That one is more specific to TypeScript, right? So, you know, it's not going to work in some of the other languages.
Actually, that's a good, just call that out too. Like we've already talked about on the podcast many times, like, and some of our guests, taking a category vulnerability and attacking it. But I think like there's a second level to that, especially, you know, well, I mean, with anything, but especially with IDOR, tech stack specific, right? So like, how it looks in Laravel versus how it might look in your Java apps or whatever. You do, like, to what you just said, you have to address those differently, find them differently. So discovery and remediation are going to look different. So you almost have to, like, yeah, bucket them into what are your most critical apps, and then tech stacks, and then burn IDOR down by tech stack.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Have an approach and then move it across. Implement as it makes sense. Cool. All right. Which, do you want to talk about TVs? What do you want to talk about?
Yeah, because that one was interesting. Yeah, let's talk about the Krebs on security LGTV thing, proxy thing, which
Okay.
is
All right.
exciting.
So Krebs came out and talks about how LG is finally going to introduce a level of security check on applications for webOS. Specifically, they're banning residential proxy SDKs from smart TV apps. Now, why? Right? And I'm trying to remember if we actually talked about this in the past. LG. No, I don't. Proxies. Nope, I don't see it in our list. So this one, I think, was in the newsletter when it first came out. Basically, what was going on is there are a bunch of these applications that can be loaded into a smart TV, LG specifically, if you have webOS, that include VPN or proxy capability that were being used and abused by data collection agencies. And they'll claim it's not abused because when you download the application for webOS, it actually has like a small thing in the acceptance, like the user acceptance, whatever criteria, language that says, hey, they can proxy traffic, or they can, at times it can be used to make calls to the internet, right? That sort of thing. But though that data access has been sold to various agencies and various, I don't know, unsavory individuals. I don't know what you want to say there. To actually use those proxies for other purposes and to gather data to bypass like international IP restrictions, so qu functioning as quasi VPNs for certain activities and other things. So there's a series of articles that came out from Krebs on this. The first one was the on July 2nd that the FBI actually seized a proxy platform that was using this technology, and then the one last week where LG is actually banning residential proxies from these apps themselves. So I'll drop the
And
other one
they're
under
going to
too.
introduce
Yes.
apparently a new process for app developers on their t their for their TVs, like a Apple's or App Store from Apple kind of thing.
I mean, this opens up a wider questions because it's not just TVs that we're concerned about here, right? Like we've seen for years, like routers get abused in this way. But IoT devices in general, as they get more powerful, the ability to add additional capabilities to those systems is really just a developer kit away. Compiling something for webOS is incredibly easy. And LG makes it easy because they want you to create new applications and new games to push out to their platform so you don't end up going and using an Apple TV or a Roku. You actually use webOS to interact with the world, right? So it makes sense. But they've never had those same level of restrictions that something like Apple has had. And it begs the question as to what other systems, what's the next IoT device that's going to be abused in this way? Right? I mean, it's going to happen, right? If anything, it'll happen, in OpenAI's lab somewhere that a camera is going to get hacked and they're going to use that to access Hugging Face next, right? But
Yeah, with
yeah.
a novel attack that didn't
A
cost
novel
much to
attack, yeah, didn't
pull off.
cost much. Yeah,
People wouldn't sell your data though, right? Like that doesn't happen, right? Come on.
that doesn't.
You talking about? Come on, guy. They don't do that. Yeah,
Yeah,
I don't know.
what?
Like people don't seem to care anymore. So I care, but and you care, and our audience cares, but people don't seem to care anymore. Their privacy is basically for sale, constantly on all devices they use. But Yeah, I don't know what next. I was actually thinking, because I know you, I don't know if you how serious you were when you asked that question, like what's the next device, but I actually was trying to kind of think about that, like what would be the next thing. I mean, I would imagine like wearables probably would be the next thing that's going to become more popular. You know, wearable devices, I'd assume. Watches and meta glasses are already out there. I'd assume six. I saw somebody do like a prototype of a whatchamacallit, a what's that? How am I forgetting this? The Hacker. It's a gaming series. 20. What am I forgetting this? Sorry, man. I'm struggling today. Give me one sec. I'm almost there. Almost there. Almost got
Cool.
it. Cyberpunk. That's the one I'm trying to think of.
Oh
So I'd
yeah.
seen somebody
Okay.
like create the cyberpunk, like a jacket with like the collar and like the arm thing and everything. So, you know, this will become more of a thing. Wearables. I'm sure that'll be the next fun one to really attack more and more. But I thought this was interesting is because I was like thinking about the attack scenario or like how this would be useful. And you and I were talking about it before the podcast started, and I was like, man, it's just wild because you can basically like these apps have a nice little connection to your device, and then they get to pretend that they're you as they go and perform whatever actions they perform, using your TV and your home as the source IP. And the ramifications for things like that are like it can get pretty crazy. Like you could make it look like someone was browsing some pretty nefarious things through that. You could blackmail people. Obviously you have access to their device. You can hide, obviously you can hide your activity. Like there's some really interesting ways to abuse this, and I see why it's valuable to have these. But what I think it, or to sorry to be able to have the one question I have though is the SDK that they mentioned. It made it sound like in the article that, did you catch whether or not it was one or a handful of SDKs or if it was a lot of different SDKs to do this? Because I got the impression, I don't know why, when I read the article for the first time, that there was only like one major SDK they were referring to, that had this like backdoor proxy functionality.
Yeah, it's I mean, there was Bright Data was the major SDK provider, but there was a couple others, right? Let me link the actual research from spur.us, right? Because it has some interesting takeaways that are in there. And then actually I'll share it really quick too, and so we can kind of
This is the article I hadn't actually seen, so I'm glad you put that up. I'd seen Preb's article, I hadn't seen this one.
This is the art. This is what they highlighted, and it's from, late June, right? It's pretty close, but they just basically scanned applications, right? Like that were provided by LG and Samsung, right? So they logged into the App Store, download it, took a look at the different SDKs that were being used there, whether it's webOS or Tizen, right? Like those are the two different providers of the operating systems that are being run. And these, 1,000 applications actually had Bright Data SDKs in them, right? For webOS, and then, 600 Bright Data for Tizen, right? And those can be used to actually do various, things. Or like, if that proxy access, like you were saying, is sold to someone or they sign up for Bright Data, proxy access, they whatever they're visiting is being recorded by your provider as you. Okay. And so the ramifications there are actually, can be pretty
Yeah.
consequential.
And so I didn't see this back in January, but sorry, this is exactly what I mean. Like, yeah, so Krebs back in January had reported on Kim Wolf, but this, so it was a botnet that abused residential proxy networks just like this. And so You think like, okay, if there's one, and by the way, when you'd mentioned Bright, I like looked through the article for Bright, and they mentioned like not just Bright, but some of subsidiaries of Bright. So it does seem like it's a pretty, so then just take all factors into account. You have this pretty singular SDK dominating pretty decent percentage of apps being installed in these apps or on these TVs. Then any weakness in that or maybe not a weakness, maybe it's intentional, right? Probably, but whatever. Let's say it's weakness or whatever you want to call it, left in there. Then yeah, you like have it. Basically, what I'm trying to say is, if you want to create a botnet that attacks a singular thing, so much easier than if this like, every app did their little proxy thing a little differently, use a little different SDK. And there's like 400 SDKs. But when you're talking about, oh, and by the way, the other interesting thing about Bright was that they're not only is it their SDK, but in a lot of cases, it's them themselves or their
They are
subsidiary
the
actually
developer.
publishing the apps. Yeah.
Yep.
So it's like, this isn't like, anyways, I won't go on any further there, but you can sort of put that all together. That's not great. That's not great.
It's not right. I mean, this always goes back to that idea that if you are not paying for an app or a service, you are the product, you are not the consumer, right? Like, they are selling that access to someone else, right? There's a reason why, social media companies and that sort of interaction is free. It's because they're making money off advertising, right? Like in this case, Bright Data is pushing out a game and then using your TV to as a proxy service that they sell to other people, right? Like, and so it continues to be a massive problem.
Not to maybe diminish this whole scenario in any way, but have you ever tried to like use an app on a t smart TV though? Like, who the fuck is installing this Pac-Man and all this stuff? It sucks. I don't want to be the person that's on there like playing, what is this, TV cooking hub? No, I mean, I'm good. Like, so who's installing this stuff too is the other question I have. Anyways, jokes aside, that's scary. That sucks. Sorry that people are doing that.
Yes. Anyway, right. So, I mean, it'll devolve from here because eventually we're going to start to see other systems or other apps that are being installed, right? Like, I mean, when do you see ChatGPT or Claude showing up on a smart TV, right? That's coming. You know that it
Dude, I'm
is.
sure.
Because that's an interface that people are actually using. It's just like any smart home utility that allows people to interact with Siri or Alexa or whatever it is, and the added access into that and using a smarter backed chat interface is coming, and then begs the question of where that actually goes. Does that interface have access to tools? What tools does it have access to? Can it
Yeah, no, it'll be
install
great.
additional things?
What it'll do is it'll use AI to watch you, and then when you're not paying attention, it will stop playing ads. So that way it can make sure that at any given time those eyeballs equal money. Not spending money for nothing. It's gonna be great for us.
It's
I think
funny.
what I've taken away from this episode today is that I am going to go live on a farm. I am going to throw away all my electronics, and I am pretty much done with this when I'm done with this. So, yeah. Last week, YouTube had Anthropic ads in the pre-roll to the live stream here.
They did.
I'm calling YouTube. I'm calling YouTube. No.
Really? Wait, where'd you see that? Oh, was that in? Oh, wow.
All right. Being
That's
targeted.
crazy. Well, I mean, we do happen to mention Claude and AI once in a while, so I guess I'm not overly that surprised that Anthropic's going to be advertising over the top of us, right?
Yes, yeah.
I don't know. What do you do anymore, right? Like,
Turn off the internet, go outside
turn
and
off the
touch
internet.
grass. and forget, unplug it all. That's my advice. Unplug everything. Go outside, take your shoes off, touch grass. It'd be nice. Touch grass.
Lovely. Just make sure you're wearing your Meta glasses so you can record that moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of which, like I saw, you know, just as a public service announcement, Meta glasses are actually banned at DEF CON this year, right? Like they have a hard fast, right? Like no recording devices. I mean, in the past, it's always been you can take a picture, but you need people's permission type thing, right? Like you can record, you need people's permission. They've decided that these are a little too invasive. I think they were actually like banned last year as well, but I did see it this year in our DEF CON subreddit. One of the organizers stepped in and actually said something about it, that's the hard stance that they are taking. So even if they're prescription glasses, doesn't matter. You've got to like take them off, or you got to have something else if you're going to be at the floor at DEF CON. And yeah, I get it. Just another PSA, download Hacker Tracker. The schedule for DEF CON is in there and it's being updated daily. So if you want to plan out your schedule, you can go favorite events. You can actually share those across with other people as well. The schedule that you build out, if there are certain items that you want to share with people, there's a bunch of new functionality that I could talk about, but as far as right, like adding events, you can add custom events nowadays, you can share custom events, you can take notes attached to a specific item or a specific event. Yeah, anyway, that's gotten better. It's been, you know, slick this year as well, but there are improvements in the latest versions. Sweet, do you want to talk
about your team does a great articles? Job.
Yeah,
thanks. I was gonna say your team does a great job. I really enjoyed the app. Appreciate you guys do that. And if you have any complaints, you know who to go to, folks.
Yeah, exactly.
Sweet. That's all I do. Follow you around complaining about Hacker Tracker's lack of AI
actually tracking
ad tracking / private reverse proxy SDKs that you don't put. I'm kidding. It is a great app. I love it. It's very useful and cool, man.
Just to ignore the bright data requests in the app this year, right? Like it's permission requests.
So we've got, just real quick before we get off here, I do want to like say one thing is that so next Tuesday, yeah, we'll be on our last day of training, so we can't give the podcast. The following Tuesday we'll be actually on our other last day of training. Maybe we'll be able to fit something in at DEF CON and Black Hat where we just like do a live stream or something. But yeah, if we don't get to that, like we won't be back on air for a couple of weeks just because of the two episode. But when we do, like, so I think that when we come back, it'd be the 18th. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It'd be the 18th of August. Jeevan from prior episodes, Jeevan Singh from, everybody knows Jeevan, but if you don't, Jeevan's at Rippling, runs security over there, was at Segment before / Twilio, and just really great practitioner. So happy to have him back on to discuss some interesting things.
Yep. He reached out to us.
They've been
implementing.
I wasn't going to talk about it. Yeah, sorry.
All I was going to say, he's got some like interesting techniques and things that they've implemented at Rippling that have been effective for managing ProdSec issues, right? That we're going to talk through. It's going to be a really good episode, especially if you are practicing and you are trying to implement security across a large number of engineering organizations and how you actually get, I don't want to say too much, get issues resolved, I guess is the only.
Exactly.
That's,
yeah.
That's as far as we'll go. So
it's hard to not give it away, but it's really cool. We're really excited to have him back on for this.
Yeah. I mean, he's a really good human as it is and has helped a ton of people in their security career. We keep trying to get him on the panels when we do those at B-Sides and other places, and you know, just has never aligned, but he's got a lot of good resources, so we'll be happy to have him back on. And yeah, otherwise I think that's it for today. Thanks again, as always, for the interactions and yeah, just being a part of the community. If you don't have access to Slack, again, email us info@absoluteappsec.com. We will get you an invite so you can join the conversation. And then thanks again to Guard Square for sponsoring today.
Yes, thank you, Guard Square.
Okay. All right. Then we will see everyone in Vegas or in a couple of weeks.
Bring sunscreen.
Bring sunscreen. Yes, it's going to be hot. Okay. Ciao.